Accession number 10012, reel number 6.
Mr. George Clayton, reel 6. We were talking about conditions in the support line billets when you were working in the front line.
Yeah.
Mainly at when you were on the Hooge thing, but also covering other times, because it's difficult, I know, to separate it. What sort of arrangements did you make for washing? Was it possible to wash at all while you were in these support lines?
For washing? Oh, well... It wasn't very... Conditions varied in different places you were in. If you had some places, all the water had to be carried in. It was there was maybe a long way to trouble to find a stream. In other places, there would be a well of some kind or a bit of a stream, which was all it required, that was very handy. That's you could find the same things here. I know there's a little stream. One's between here and Stanley, near where the Central Methodist Church used to be.
You couldn't usually wash because you wouldn't have enough water. That would be the case.
Oh,
while you're in the line.
Sometimes there was no water. There was no water. Only what you got, you required for making your tea and doing your cooking with.
What arrangements did they make for latrines?
Well, that was generally a biscuit tin in a recess in the trench with a bit of a wood, and there was a big bucket, and you could sit on there and do it there. But that had to be emptied every day and buried. It was buried in the trench bottom. It was just a clay bottom generally, and they could dig a hole and tip it in there. Oh, yes, there was latrines, and it was all no very particular about that, and having all that disposed of, otherwise it would maybe become a danger, you know. The smell of it would...
You weren't allowed to just go anywhere, then? They were strict about that?
Yes, they were strict about that. I will say you had to use the latrine, because there was a bucket in there, and it was emptied every night.
Did they provide you with paper, or did you have to provide your own?
You had to find your own paper. No. But there was any time. We used to get newspapers sent from England, you know. They come through the post, and you found paper that way, yes.
You said you got letters from home and newspapers. That was while you were in the front, in the support and reserve and front line. You'd get them.
Oh yes, yeah. The mail came in every night. If it wasn't destroyed by shell fire or prevented by shell fire, but normally it left your billet every night. And I remember once it was on the Christmas of 1915, and the mail that night, it was struck by a shell on the Christmas Eve, and the only thing that wasn't damaged or destroyed was the mailbag, for some reason or other. Now then, the mailbag got in, and there was a parcel in for me, and it was my wife and I used to attend the Presbyterian Church here, and the ladies of the Presbyterian Church, they got together and they sent a parcel to every one of the members that was on active service during that war, so that you'd be able to get it for the Christmas. Well, I never forget that, because it was a jolly good parcel, any amount of cakes, you know, that we didn't get, and biscuits, and they said there were chocolates and cigarettes as well. And some didn't get a parcel, but quite a few did came up with that mail.
Would you share parcels?
Yes, we should share them. Yes, I will say that's one thing you find in the army, a different civilian life. Yes, an army life, different to a civilian life. Everybody in civilian life seems to me, or it seemed to do when I first come home, that everybody was just wanting money. It didn't matter how you got it, get it. That was the idea of civilian life, but I couldn't say that in the army. No, you would share your fags, and you would share your parcels, and oh yes, there's a fine feeling. I often find it yet. I maybe being out, maybe talking to somebody being in the First World War, and there seems to be something there that you come with still. I cannot describe it, but I can feel it. When I get on talking to a man who was in the First World War, and he was maybe in some of the sectors of the line that I've been in myself, and you find a comradeship strikes up. And you know, when you leave the army, at the end of the army, as I do, well, I felt the feeling that it's everybody for himself. And get the money, no matter how you get it, but get it. That was the main thing. But
did you have a
not the comradeship.
Did you have a special friend that you'd share things with, you know?
A special well, usually you made pals, you know. Yes, I will say that. There's some people that you become friendly with at once. You're like, well, he'll follow well met, but others, yeah, seem to be different temperaments, but I find yet that the fellows that, you know, in the First World War that I've talked to, there seems to be a comradeship that doesn't exist if you meet a fellow casually. It was never one in a something like that. It may be the same thing as a man, what have you been walking for, what you worked with, and you meet him again years after, well, there's still that friendship, you know. That may be it. Yes.
Were your letters very important to you from home and the ones you wrote?
Oh, yes. Yes, you liked the letter. And you could send as many letters as you had in mind. That's one thing. You hadn't any stamps to put on your letters, you know. You could write it. There was a lot of letters sent away from France because none for posters. And then when you were out in your out the trenches or near your billet, there was usually what they called the YMCA. Well, these YMCAs, they had free writing paper. And you usually get yourself a few sheets when you were in the YMCA. I know when I found the YMCA, the first thing I used to look for was for some writing paper.
Who did you write to?
I wrote to my wife, and I wrote to my relations, and that was a daily occurrence, because it costs not for postage, and you used to put your time in. And
so you'd write every day to your wife, would you?
Almost every day, I would say. And she wrote regular to me, but she had to put a stamp on hers, but I could send mine free.
What sort of things would you say in your letters, because they were all censored, weren't they?
All censored. Well, you hadn't say anything about the name of where you were, or you hadn't to divulge anything that would maybe be useful to say what part of the line you were on and what you were doing or anything of that. You had to leave that all out. It had to be just, well, keep off the war as much as possible. They were censored, and it had to be the post every night was taken into the officer's mess and put on the table there, and they were given a handful of letters that they had to censor. And they had their pencils, and if there was anything that was likely for giving any information that may eventually come to the Germans, that was always read out, you know. If you made any movement at all, it went from one part of the line to another, when there was likely to be an attack of anything of that, well, that was rubbed out.
Did you mind them censoring your letters?
Eh?
Did you mind them censoring your letters?
Well, sometimes I couldn't see any sense in it. where to, it had nothing to do with that would have been aiding the enemy in any way. But there was difference of officers, and sometimes the wife said, the letter she received, there was no part of it censored, which must adhere to the rules.
Yes. Yeah. Did you have any green envelopes?
Oh, yes, green envelopes. No, what, yes, there were green envelopes, and they were very valuable then. Yes, you were on your word of honour that there was nothing in there but was what just of your own personal matter. Yes, and a green envelope, oh yes, they're very precious then, because you knew when you were posting that it wasn't to be censored. But they could be censored in England, and if there was anything found out that was what you shouldn't have in, then you would be severely censored, if not convicted for it, you know, they say. Oh yes, it had that was, you were given them on the understanding that there was nothing that would be any value to the enemy.
You said they were very precious. Was there a shortage of them? Did you not get enough of them for your needs?
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes there's a few circulating, sometimes they were very difficult to get a hold of. Yes, because anybody would better grab for a green envelope if they could get one, because you liked the idea that your letter wasn't going to be censored. And it was on the outside, you were on your honour, that there was nothing in this letter that would be of any value to the enemy.
What sort of thing did you write about? Can you remember? Were you optimistic? You know, did you
Yes, what a lot of letters. Well, I can't say there was anything particular. What about just like what I say that I was well and enjoying good health, or if I wasn't so well, they'd certainly let them know your health. That was about the first thing you wrote about. And maybe tell them that my leave was approaching, and I had only another 3 months to wait, and then I would hope to get home then. Well, I was out there.
You didn't talk about tunnelling at all?
Oh, no, yeah, I had to keep off that. Well, they knew I was tunnelling because my address was the 175 Company of Royal Engineers, and we were all termed sappers. That was my rank, a sapper. Sapper George Clayton. That was yes, and then I had a number, a regimental number, I think it was 10-23-22, the Royal Engineers, the 175 Company, Expeditionary Force, France. That was my address.
And what would people write to, what would your relatives and your wife, what would they write to you about, just what was going on at home?
Well, they'd tell us what was going on at home, and how well my friends was keeping, and how they were keeping, and sometimes the one letter wasn't a great lot different to the other, you know.
But it cheered you up.
Beg pardon?
But it cheered you up, did it?
Oh, yes, you like to get a letter from home. I've seen a man crying. It was the man, Tommy Greathead, they called him. He lived about here. And it was when we first went out. Well, the post corporal, he came in with the letters, and he shouted your name out of a crowd of you, you know, and but everybody I remember once got a one with Tommy Greathead, and that went on for a few days, no letter from home. And well, I will say letters were a daily occurrence. There were a lot of people who got letters every day.
Even in the line?
Yeah, in the line,
when
yes.
When it got through?
Yes. But Tommy cried. He went that long and I never got a letter from home. Oh, a letter from home seemed to keep you going. Aye, poor Tommy. He got out the war. He did, no. The same regiment as me.
Now, what was your sort of daily routine like? You had your 8-hour shift in which you were working. What would you do with the other 16 hours? You'd sleep?
Well, there was a lot of card playing. Cards, you know.
In the dugout?
In the dugout, yes, yes. The cards were on the go.
What sort of game?
Whist, usually, yes, and that's what was the...
Not gambling, then?
Oh, yes, there was gambling as well. We had the corn and anchor. Have you ever played it, that game? Oh,
can you explain it? Do you remember how you played it?
Well, it was a corner. It was a dice, and there was so much you won if a corn came up, and so much if the anchor came up, and then there'll be some other figures on there, but... Oh, yes, there was a lot of gambling. A lot of gambling.
What size stakes was it for?
Eh?
Was it for a lot of money, or just for halfpennies or whatever?
I knew one fella. He was worth thousands of francs. But he was a remarkable good whist player. A man named Toulon. He came from Yorkshire somewhere. But by Jove, he had a lot of money that won, and you know, all we could draw was about 10 francs a week, and you maybe had to wait, oh, if you win the line, you got no pay at all, but what money you took to the line, but you'll have to be in your pockets.
Did you gamble much? Would you be a winner or a loser, or what?
I can't say I was ever a great gambler. I have put a few francs on the corn and anchor. That's a dice game, you know. If the corn comes up, it's a board. I think there's about six of you. Pounds and I.
1.6 square.
Yes, I forget. No, forgot. But I played that game many times. I can't say I was ever very fortunate at it. I think me, but. I seem to know when to stop.
What other recreations would you have during the, you know...
Oh, when you walked the lines, there
not,
was...
Not in the line. I mean in the line, really.
Well, there was reading. There was reading, and there was writing, and there was the cards, and the corner and anchor.
Did you get... You've had 8 hours working. Did you have any other duties to do other than your 8-hour shift?
Well, there was a cooks. They didn't go down the subs at all, you know. And
but for you, I mean, would you have anything else to do at all for those 16 hours?
No, that was my job. That would be Russian parties to seek the Russians, you know. But they were excused fatigues if you had been out seeking the Russians. Well, I think... That excused your duty from going down the mine shaft. That did. Because, you know, it took a few hours sometimes to get your rations in. You had to maybe walk about 4 miles away from where the trench was, from where the dumping ground was with the rations. And that would constitute your shift, yes.
Would you be very tired after a shift?
Do what?
Were you very tired after a shift?
Oh, sometimes you were. And sometimes you were cold, and sometimes you were wet, and been standing in water or something like that. And oh, yes, and...
Would you get the chance to recover? By the time you had your next shift, would you be back?
Well...
Or would it get worse and worse?
It was worse when my force went out, because it was 7 days a week for the first month. Well, a month before we got relieved. And then later on, as more men got out, it got down to about a fortnight in, a fortnight out.
After this, at the end of the first month, were you very tired then, before they blew up?
By the time you'd had enough of it, because you were lousy for one thing, and you just had to stay in the part of the trench that you were in, you know, and you couldn't run about the trenches the way you can where we are now. Oh no.
Could you get dry again? You said you were often wet or dirty. Could you get dry?
Well, you're close enough not to dry, aren't you? Yes, and I know. I used to sleep in my socks to dry them, and I found the next one that were dry. Take my socks off, but you weren't supposed to take any of your boots or your stockings off when you were in the front line trench, you know, but we used to do it. But you were taking a chance. Yeah, there was nobody supposed to take his boots off.
Did you know why?
Did I know why?
You weren't supposed to take your boots
well,
off.
Well, I suppose if an enemy attacked, you wouldn't be very much use if you were just in your stocking feet. Better if you had your boots on. But, you weren't supposed to take them off. But, you know, it's not very nice sleeping with your boots on. You might sleep with your stockings on, but sleeping with your boots on is a different thing altogether. We got away with it anyway. I was never crying for it, and I may say there has been time when I've slept with my boots on, but there's been times when I took them off as well.
What was the health like, say, at the end of this first month? What was everybody starting to suffer a bit?
There was a sick list every morning, you know. But
what was the cause? What was the problem with the people on the sick list?
Well, a lot of people got frozen feet in winter time. That was quite a common thing, what they call frozen feet.
And what about that? But for instance, the hooge, that was in the middle of summer. At the end of that month, how were the people
But I can say for myself, I never had a sick report. And it's out there 2.5 years, and I never once went sick. I was wounded, and that finished me out there, but I can never remember having a sick report. And whether it was the open air life that we were living had something to do with it, but I went through winter and summer and never had a sick report.
Did any of the men who did go on sick report, did you think any of them were malingering?
There's no mistake about that. There was a chap, he put a bag full of sand over his foot. A bag full of sand, and he fired a shot through it. You see, the bag of sand, it prevented a lot of blistering that would have been done if he just shot through his bare feet. That was to make it appear that it had been beyond enemy action, you see. It would betray that it was a self-inflicted wound if you hadn't that bag of sand over the top. But there was quite a few. In fact, I knew a man
was... When was that? Can you remember when he did that? Can you remember when he did that? Part of the war he
was? I never did that.
No, what part of the war he did it? What year was that? That wouldn't be when he straight got out there, would it?
Oh, it would be. It was up on the front line. And I know I was once out seeking the rations. And there was a... It was a Scotsman, a Scottish regiment. He was wandering about away from where the dump was there. I says, you want to keep away from there, man. I says, the snipers will get you. I says, it's pretty. He says, that's what I'm here for. He says, I'm hoping that I'll get a blighty. That he was trying to get a wound that would get him out of it. He was that fed up. That's the reason he was wandering about. He was chancing his life in the hope that it would maybe be a blighty. Because I can say this, for every man that's killed, there's 10 or 15 wounded, you know. Yes. And the most vulnerable part of the body to be hit was in the head. If you're hit in the head, your skull was split and the back of the head used to be left open there. It was nearly always vital. That's the reason that the tin hats came into operation. But you can be wounded in all parts of the legs and the arms, in the body, wounded. But in the head, you can see nearly 9 times out of 10 it was fatal. A dreadful job. Oh.
What did you feel about this chap you knew shot his own foot?
The what?
The bloke who shot his own foot. How did you feel about that? Would anyone report him, or did people look down on him? What did they think?
I don't think anybody reported him. He'd been wounded, and that was a way of getting out of it. That was his way of getting out of it, anyway. As far as I know, he got through with it all right. He wounded himself, and there was nothing to portray it being a self-inflicted wound, do you see? If he just fade away from here, where the... It would be scarred. It would betray itself that...
How much sand did he put in the sandbag?
How much sand? Oh, it'd probably be full. Maybe be full or half full. And he could still put a sandbag...
Did you see him do it, or did you hear about it?
Well, I think I heard about it. I can't say it. I saw him do it, but...
Were there any other malingerers in your company or your section? Were there any other people who'd go sick when they weren't sick or things like that?
Yes, but you could be claimed. They used to call that malingering, if you were caught, you know. But well, I would say the majority of people. But there's always a majority of the people that carried out everything that was required of them. But there was some that. More malingerers, you know, and some get very clever at that as well, you know. How to dodge the column, we used to call it. You met all kinds of people in the army, but there was high class and low class, and you were all one class.
How did you get on with the rest of the people in your... Were you in sections?
Yes.
Get on with them?
Well, I've known... fights among them, but...
What would they be about?
I can't tell you, but there was certainly plenty of fights one time or another. One fell out with another. I don't know why, but I can't say it. I had any trouble in that direction.
Was morale good amongst the men? Did they stay cheerful, or would they get a bit depressed after a long period of digging?
Oh, I'd say that... just for months and months you never saw a woman, you know. The civilians had all left it, and when you walked the lines, there was many times those civilians that they knew there was a danger of them being blown away with shells, you know, and plenty of the houses were smashed up. Well, there wasn't some places I've been in, there wasn't a whole house. And, I can say that, the Malingon, as it was called, it did happen. And if anybody was caught Malingon, he was tied under the wheel. He was severely dealt with, you know. The
field punishment number one.
Oh, I used to think that number one field punishment, that was maybe you'd be tied onto the wheel of a gun carriage. And the worst thing, you see, your two hands was fastened. And it was the flies. The flies, your arms was maybe bound to your body there. And you couldn't, if a fly let on your face, which there was plenty of flies in summertime in France, you couldn't do anything to knock it off. Your hands were there. And I've seen people nearly frantic because flies was bothering them and couldn't do anything to knock them off. They were tied onto the wheel of a gun carriage or something like that.
Did any of your company get number one field punishment?
Oh, yes, I've seen them tied to the wheel.
Of your own unit?
I was never... I was never had any claims against me at all. That's one thing.
Other people in your unit got that, did they?
Oh yes, there was always some defaulters, as they called them, and some used to lose so much pay, you know, if they were defaulters. You tried in front of an officer, taken in with a sergeant major, and you had to take your hat off and give them the call to yourself. The thing that there was most crime for was absent without leave. That is, when they got home on leave, they wouldn't go back till about 2 or 3 days after the leave had expired, you know. And then you were crime for it. You had to go, and Sergeant Major would take you in to see the commanding officer. You had to give an account about why this had happened. Of course, some